Okay, so let us go on to the last couple of contemplations that are found here. We have now seen some of the important ones. What comes now is a little bit different from what we usually find in the suttas. So let's have a look at this. And what should be described as liable to sorrow? You see, the word there is soka, sorrow, but quite similar to sorrow in a sense, which is fascinating. I wonder if there is a connection there to soka and sorrow. Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to sorrow. That's already quite interesting, isn't it? The idea that animals are liable to sorrow, because very much of the kind of world view that we had in the Western world for a long time that comes from Christianity, that animals are just like machines. They don't really have feelings. But right here you can see the idea from the suttas is very different. The idea that the animals have feelings just like any other beings. And anyone who has had a close animal in their life, like a pet, a dog or a cat or something, will probably know that animals have feelings. It's kind of, I don't know, sometimes it's kind of weird how we get this idea that animals are like machines. I don't know where we get these ideas from when it kind of is so intuitively obvious that that actually is not the case. So they are liable to sorrow. These attachments are liable to sorrow. Someone who is tied, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to sorrow, seeks what is also liable to sorrow. So, sadness and sorrow and grief and all of these things are part of life, This is an essential part of existence. It's useful, again, to remember that. Don't think that you're going to be able to live the rest of your life without these things. This is kind of very much part and parcel for what our existence is like. And even if you haven't got it now, it's going to come back to you. Almost everyone is going to have some degree of grief and sorrow in their life. It's interesting, even, when you read the suttas, you see even people like Venerable Ananda, when the Buddha was about to pass away, he was crying, And he was a stream enter. He was someone who already had seen the Dhamma. You would think that someone like that would not be able to cry because they had a kind of larger scope, a larger understanding of reality. But these attachments that we have, they are so profound and so deep that even when you have deep insight and deep wisdom into reality, we feel these are natural human feelings that come very easily to us. So sorrow is a natural part of existence. Once you attach to things, once you enjoy the world of the five senses, people often say, what's wrong with enjoying the world of the five senses? Well, what is the downside of it is that we sorrow. There's going to be sadness when there is separation. And that is just part and parcel of life. It is one of those strange things about the world outside of us. Sometimes people say that Buddhists exaggerate because we say everything is dukkha. But surely, look at the happiness in the world. The beautiful sunset, the kind of the nature is very beautiful and all of these kind of things. And the Buddha does not deny that there is happiness in the world of the five senses. There is happiness in that world, right? We all have enjoyment of these things. The problem is that the nature of the world of the five senses is such that when we enjoy it, we also attach to it. We grasp on, we crave for these things, we hold on to the things that we enjoy. Why? Because we want to control it. If we can't control it, we lose it, we suffer. We want to control it, that's why we attach. That's the nature of that world. So soon as you start enjoying that world, at that moment, you start holding on, grasping to that world, attaching to it. And the moment you grasp, you're asking for suffering. Please, may I suffer. That's what you say. That is the problem. So don't say, please, may I suffer. There is a nice little simile that is found in the sutta, the simile of the grass torch. And the simile of the grass torch, the Buddha says, that sensual pleasures or the worldly happiness is like a grass torch. You pick up the grass torch, and then you hold the grass torch against the wind. when you hold the grass torch against the wind, because it is a grass torch, the embers will come off that grass torch. The embers will hit your robe or whatever you're wearing, and you will start to burn, yeah? And when you burn, what happens? Well, either you suffer enormously because you get burnt, or you might die, yeah? And this is the idea of sensual pleasure. If you hold the sensual pleasure, so the first thing is to notice that the grass torch is useful because it gives you light at night when you see, right? In the same way, sensual pleasures have a degree of happiness about them. It's called the asada in the suttas, the gratification of sensual pleasures. But then when you hold them in the wrong way, and holding them in the wrong way is the idea of attaching to these things too firmly. When you attach them to them too firmly, then it's going to hit you. It's going to start burning you, and you're going to have some terrible consequences because of holding those sensual pleasures in the wrong way. So we should turn around. We should hold the sensual pleasures downwind, yeah, away from the windy direction, so that the embers go away from us. And that means we have no choice. We have to live in the sensory world. The sensory world is always around us. But we learn to live in the sensory world in such a way that we don't attach so much, because we understand the danger of attachment. So we enjoy our lunch. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed your lunch. Yeah, otherwise you're not following my instructions. My instruction is enjoy your lunch, because that's what I learned from Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm told me enjoy your lunch, and I'm telling you enjoy your lunch. So enjoy it. But don't attach too much on it. Yeah, you don't attach so much anyway to the lunch, right? Let's face it. You forget about it very quickly afterwards. So you let go of it, and then you carry on. And this is the same way with everything in this world. You learn to gradually loosen the grip a little bit. And when you loosen that grip, then the grass torch doesn't blow the embers onto you anymore. And you don't suffer as much as a consequence. There is less sorrow in your life. There's less grief because of less attachment to these kind of things. So then instead of sorrowing because of all the negative things in the world and because of holding on to other things that also sorrow, yeah, if you have a partner, if you have kids, when you die, they will sorrow. When they die, you will sorrow, etc. So, you know, it's going to be sorrow all the way around. You stop that. You let go of these things a little bit. And as you let go of that world a little bit, and you ascend the mind, you allow the mind to rise to higher realm, a realm where there's less attachment to the world, where there's more bliss and more happiness, you are a winner all around, in all possible directions. So let's come to the next one. And what should be described as liable to corruption? Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle, gold and money are liable to corruption. These attachments are liable to corruption. Someone who is tied, infatuated, and attracted, attached to these things, themselves liable to corruption, seeks what is also liable to corruption. This is the ignoble search. So here we have this idea of corruption. You can see there that the word for corruption is sankilesa. Yeah, you see the word there? You recognize that word? Yeah. Sankilesa is sang plus kilesa. Kilesa is a kind of standard word for defilement, kile, the same tie, and in the suttas it's called sankilesa or upakilesa, and sometimes kilesa, but usually upakilesa is a more common word in the suttas. And so these things are liable to corruption. What does that mean? Well, you can see here there's a new entry now. Gold and money has been added to the list, right? Now, what is interesting about this is that gold and money did not occur previously. It was not part of all the other things, being born, being old, and dying, and all that kind of things. And a reason for that is because the word birth, old age, sickness, and death, the way they are used in the suttas, they are used in a literal way, not in a metaphorical sense. Yeah. And that is a very important observation, because sometimes we think that when the words like death are meant metaphorically, or birth or rebirth are meant metaphorically, it does not refer to ordinary rebirth or birth, but it refers to some kind of mental content, the mind being reborn, the mind changing. But actually, these words are not used like that in the sutta. They're not used metaphorically. They are used to literally mean birth, old age, and death. So the idea that these things can somehow refer to there's a bit of dukkha on the side here. So understood. Just trying to get rid of dukkha. It's very, very. It's not going to work. But anyway, we'll see what happens. So they are not used metaphorically. And this is a very important point of Dhamma. So when it comes to things like dependent origination, you have a bhava paccaya jati, jata paccaya jara marana. Yeah, from existence comes birth, from birth comes old age and death. It is not metaphorical in meaning. It means literal birth, and it means literal old age and death. It's very, very important. And it's very obvious when you know the sutta as well, because that's how it is defined everywhere, defined as these kind of things. So that is kind of the first thing here, yeah? And this is why golden money appears only now, because it could have appeared before, in which case it would have had to have a metaphorical meaning, because of course, golden money is not really born. It is made, and metaphorically you can call that birth, but actually, that is not how birth is used in the suttas. So what does it mean that gold and money are liable to corruption? Well, of course, it means that they can be false, yeah, they can be not real gold and money. Somebody has added too much copper to the gold. I'm going to make a killing. Not that it's not going to be pure gold. I'm going to rip you off and I'm going to charge the full price or something like that. And this is the problem with the things of the world when they are liable to corruption, they're liable to being defiled. This is the word sankilesa here. And when they are liable to defilement, liable to being false or whatever, then they are really problematic, and they destroy kind of the value of these things, yeah? The value of gold and money is destroyed if they're lying, liable to corruption. In the same way, partners and children, because they are liable to corruption, it kind of destroys the idea of having a partner in life, right? Why do we want to have a partner in life? Why do you want to have a girlfriend and boyfriend? Why do you want to have a husband or wife? Why do you want to have any kind of partner, dependent, irrespective of your kind of your ideas of what kind of partner you should have? Why? Well, usually the reason why we want to have a partner is because we think they are so wonderful. Yeah, when you fall in love with someone, wow, it is so beautiful, it is so wonderful. You forget that the person is liable to corruption. That's what you find out later on. Oh, I didn't know you were liable to corruption. That's bad. Bad idea. Yeah, they turn out to have corruptions in them. What are those corruptions? Well, those corruptions are in the human mind are things like anger, things like jealousy, things like greed, things that we don't really want to see in a nice partner, right? These are the corruptions of the human mind, and we all have them. But it's not just that we have them. Very often, given the right circumstances, given the hanging around the, not the kalyana mitta, but the papa mitta. You know the papa mitta? The bad friend, yeah? Papa is like the evil or bad friend, yeah? So the papa mitta is the bad friend. So don't have papa mitta, have a kalyana mitta. So by hanging around with the wrong people, being conditioned in the wrong way, these defilements are going to come out. Yeah, these corruptions are there. They are under the surface, waiting to come out, given the right circumstances. And that is what is so scary. So our partner, our children, right? When you go away somewhere, you want your children to behave in the right way. And when you are a child, you want your parents to behave in the right way. They're not going to do it. Yeah, they are liable to corruption. You can't control your children. And if you try, it's going to get worse usually. And so, this is kind of the downside of these things. We don't know where they're going to go. We don't know what's going to happen with these things. Yeah, it takes out the romance of life when we think about life in a very rational way. It destroys some of the ideas why romantic relationships are so interesting. Actually, when it comes down to it, in the kind of broader view of things, it is not all that interesting at all. But it's incredibly hard to see sometimes. Partner and children are liable to corruption. Male and female bondservants. Maybe you had some very nice servants, very nice slaves, very nice volunteers. I like that one. Why? You know, that's a good one. The volunteers are the real slaves of this world. Actually, that's not fair to say. I really recommend that you volunteer. It's a wonderful thing to do. And to see you as slaves is incredibly unfair. You're making good karma and you're also helping out a good organization like the BGF. So please carry on volunteering. It's a wonderful thing here. But they are subject to defilements, right? You have someone who you trust in your house, someone who you kind of, you rely on to get the things done in your house. And then they get corrupted. Things go wrong. They start stealing from you or whatever. That is the reality of these things. Goats, even goats and sheep and chickens and pigs are subject to defilement. One day they get angry with you, right? One day the elephant is no longer happy. And they trample on you. And when the elephant tramples on you, you become very flat. Yeah? that is the downside of elephants. And I have heard many cases of monks dying because of elephants. Yeah? Especially in places like Sri Lanka, there's still lots of wild elephants in the forest. And if the elephant has a bad day, it gets corrupted, as it says here, gets angry for whatever reason, that's it. You're finished. Yeah? Happen very, very easily with elephants. They're incredibly powerful animals. So it's all liable to corruption. And anything that is liable to corruption is not really interesting anymore. Corrupt things are not nice. We want pure things in our life. We want beautiful things. We want things that are attractive. We don't want things that are defiled and corrupted and kind of low in a sense. We want high things in our life. That is what is interesting here. All of these things are liable to corruption. Huh? So you're attached to all of these things that are liable to corruption, infatuated with them, tied to them, and because of that, you are actually seeking things that are liable to corruption. Remember that. When you're looking for the things in the world, you're seeking things that are liable to corruption. It is not so nice all of a sudden. Suddenly, the sheen is taken off these things. This is the ignoble search. So now you can see why this is ignoble, right? It's pretty obvious because it is leads to suffering, it leads to problems, it leads to all kind of negative things. It is not the noble mind that is pure. The noble mind is not that stands back, that sees reality with a clear mind, is careful, is circumspect, has a degree of wisdom, has the yoni sammanasikara, has the sati sampajanya to be able to stand back and see clearly what is going on. So let's find out a bit more about this noble search. What is the noble search? It is when someone who is themselves liable to be reborn, understanding the drawbacks of being liable to reborn, seeks the unborn supreme sanctuary extinguishment. Yeah? So the moment you understand the drawbacks of being liable to being reborn, yeah, that is really the critical thing here. I mentioned before, we were talking about the pleasures of the world. I said the pleasures of the world, they have a degree of happiness to them, right? When we enjoy a nice meal, when we have a nice relationship, there is a degree of happiness in that. But what we often forget is the downside. We forget the drawback, and that is the problem. Every nice relationship must end in separation. That is the drawback of a nice relationship. Every nice relationship may end in corruption, as we have just seen now. This is the drawback. And so the Buddha weighs up the drawbacks and the advantages, and he says the drawback is far greater. And there is a greater reality beyond. That is the nisarana, the escape. The three things the Buddha talks about in the suttas asada, adinava, and nisarana. Asada is the gratification or pleasure in something. The adinava is the danger or drawback, and the nisarana is the escape. So you weigh it up, and you said the actual drawback is really enormous. Then there is the escape, and of course the escape from the sensory world is the world of samadhi, yeah, the world of the jhanas. And it's a far more happy, far more satisfactory and contented world than the world of the worldly things, the sensory pleasures of the world. So you weigh things up and you decide, okay, I'm going to go for the escape, because the world of the five senses is just too dangerous. There's too many downsides, too much suffering. I've had enough of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Now I want to move out of this. So understanding the drawbacks, you seek the unborn. Yeah, unborn is here the ajata. You see it over here, the ajatang. Yeah, and so the unborn here, what it really means, it means the freedom from birth. Or freedom from being reborn. The A is what is called a privative prefix, and it means like the freedom from that thing, from that word it is in front of. Ajatang, non-birth, freedom from birth. So you see the danger in birth, you seek the freedom from birth. And this is what is meant here by the unborn, the freedom from birth. It doesn't mean some kind of unborn state, it just means the freedom from that birth. Yeah, so you seek that freedom from birth, the supreme sanctuary, anuttarang yoga kemang. Yeah, you see right here, yoga kemang. Anuttarang yoga kemang, the supreme sanctuary. Yoga in Pali does not mean the kind of exercises you do when you're sitting on the floor, yeah, or lying on the floor, kind of the asana, that's what it means. Yoga has two meanings in the suttas, and one meaning is exertion, you are exerting yourself. And another meaning is the word yoke. You yoke things together. And you can see that the word yoke in English is related to the word yoga in Pali. It's the same word. Remember, we're dealing with the same languages. It's called the Indo-European languages. So all of these languages are linked to each other. Lots of English words that come straight out of Sanskrit and Pali. Yoga and yoke are connected. So yoke is when you yoke things together. And of course, when you yoke oxen together to pull the plow or to pull the cart or whatever, that's when work gets done. So the yoking is very similar to the idea of exertion. So kema means like safety or freedom from something. So here we have the safety or the ending of exertion. Yeah, the freedom from exertion. That's why it is called the supreme sanctuary, because you no longer have to exert yourself on the Buddhist path. You have found the sanctuary, the liberation, the place where all of these problems come to an end, and there's no more exertion that is required from you. So this is the idea of the yoga kemang, the supreme sanctuary. Sanctuary is a nice word for yoga kema. Sanctuary is like this feeling that you can relax for once in your life. There's nothing more to be done. You can kind of be at ease for once. You have been persecuted all your life. By what? By greed, hatred, and delusion. Persecuted by your own defilements. Now finally, you find a rest from those blooming defilements. And now you can really chill for the first time. And of course, that supreme sanctuary is also called Nibbana, right? The right next word here is Nibbana. And Nibbana here, translated by Bhantasujato as extinguishment. Yeah, you have extinguished things in your life. What have you extinguished? You have extinguished the defilements of the mind that are so problematic and always causing so much suffering for yourself. You have extinguished suffering itself. No more suffering. This is what extinguishment refers to. Yeah. So you have found that sanctuary from all of these kind of things. It is very important to translate words like Nibbana. If you don't translate a word like Nibbana, people will read anything into it. Right? But the point is that the word Nibbana has a very specific meaning. Remember, these are teachings that were given in the Indian context 2,500 years ago. And in that Indian context, when the Buddha was giving teaching to the audience in front of him, they knew the meaning of Nibbana. For them, it had a meaning. But if I tell you the word Nibbana, it means nothing, right? It doesn't have any meaning to you. Just Nibbana, sure, I know what it means. No, actually, you don't know what it means. Because you are not grown up with Sanskrit or Pali. So you don't know. So because of that, it's important that we translate it, that we hear the same meaning as the ancient Indians were hearing when they heard these words. That's why it should be translated as extinguishment, and then we are closer to understanding what these things are about. So this is, to my mind, the right way of translating for that reason. Yeah. So you seek the freedom from birth, the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. And perhaps you think that extinguishment doesn't sound so interesting. I don't want to be extinguished, thank you very much. If you don't want to be extinguished, the door is over there. Otherwise you're going to be extinguished. This is here, you are on the path to extinguishment. And so we see here what the Buddha does. He kind of balances things out a little bit. He used the term extinguishment on the one hand, which is like a slightly negative term. But on the other hand, he uses the word sanctuary, which is a very positive term. And this is very important when we think about the Buddhist teachings. The negative is always balanced by the positive. Yeah, because the negative, the reason why the Buddha uses the negative terms, is because these teachings are very profound. And the full profundity can really only be understood through the negative terms. But from our point of view, through the point of view of ordinary people, these are very positive and happy states. Yeah, these are the highest happiness you can possibly get in the world. Yeah, so it's very important to remind ourselves that when the Buddha uses a negative term because of the profundity, actually, for most people, it has a very, very positive meaning. These are very, very happy things. You cannot find greater happiness in your existence than these things. So the balance is always there. And that's why we should be very careful, as I like to say, to be too negative in Buddhism. Yeah? You always hear from other people, "Are you, you Buddhist, you're so negative. Yeah, dukkha here, dukkha there, dukkha everywhere. And don't want to have anything to do with you anymore." But actually, when you start reading the suttas, there's also sukha everywhere. There's happiness everywhere, right? The Buddhist path of meditation is full of happiness. It's such a beautiful path. And I think that if we get better at marketing the Buddhist teachings, we're going to have more success in the world to have more people become Buddhist, because everyone should be a Buddhist. Isn't that right? Why isn't everyone a Buddhist? This is the best teachings in the world. Don't other people want the best teachings? They're missing out. Right? Listen, mate, you're missing out on this beautiful teaching. To me, it's kind of obvious, you know. I grew up in the Christian country, and Christianity, they are nice Christian people. But the teachings in Christianity, I don't know, don't make any sense to me, sorry. when you compare the content of the Bible with the content of the suttas, it's like night and day, right? I mean, seriously, how can you even begin to read the Bible after reading the suttas? I'm just saying, listen, okay, read properly. To me, it doesn't make any sense at all. To me, these are the best suttas. And I think sometimes we are not really selling the suttas properly, selling the Buddhist teaching properly, because they are so, really so beautiful. If anyone wants to be happy, if anyone wants to discover the meaning of life, this is where it is found. It is very difficult to see how it can be found on some of these other teachings. Anyway. I'm not going to. Let's move on. So then we have, of course, the same thing with all of these other problems. Themselves liable to grow old, to fall sick, to die, to sorrow, to become corrupted. Understanding the drawbacks in these things, they seek the unaging, the unailing, the undying, the sorrowless, the uncorrupted supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. Yeah, so here we have the same problems. So you are seeking the freedom from these things. Yeah, he has here the unaging, but really, I think a better translation would be to call it the freedom from old age. He has the unailing, I would call that the freedom from sickness. The undying, I would call it the freedom from death. Sorrowless, freedom from sorrow. Uncorrupted, freedom from corruption. I mean, they are basically the same meaning, but it's a little bit more clear when we say freedom from corruption. So, again, the ending of all the problems in life. This is what the Buddha is actually promising us here with these things. And one of the things I didn't mention before, which maybe I should mention very briefly, because what we are dealing with here is rebirth, we are also dealing with not just not aging, we are dealing not with just with aging, but with re-aging. We're not just dealing with dying, but re-dying. Not just sorrow, but re-sorrow. And re-corruption. So the idea here is that the sequence of terms is always the same. Birth comes first. And because birth is rebirth, all of these things are the carrying on of these problems into the future. The fact that we die not only once, but again and again and again in future lives. That is the real problem. If you were only to die once in this particular life, and that would be the end of it, you could probably deal with it. Once is okay. But the problem is the ongoing process of these things carrying on again and again for an unlimited time into the future. So what we're doing here is we're stopping this process. We will still die in this life. When we say the Buddha has found the undying, it doesn't mean the Buddha will not die. Of course the Buddha will die. Everyone has to die, whether you're arahant or whatever. But it means that re-dying, re-old age, all of these things have come to an end. Birth comes first, and therefore all of these things also have to do with the re-occurring of these processes. So undying, the freedom from death, and all the way down. And again, it is the supreme sanctuary, the extinguishment that we then are leaning towards, and what this is all about. And this is the noble search. And you can start to see why it is called noble, right? Because it is kind of amazing that anyone in the world would go out and search for these things. I always found it kind of one of the things that I really am so impressed about the Buddha or the Buddha-to-be, is that he's staying at home in an ordinary life, and he was a wealthy person living in a wealthy family. He had really everything that he wanted. And then he says, I'm going to find the solution to death. And then he wanders off into the forest somewhere to find the solution to death. And that's kind of amazing, right? It's kind of extraordinary. Of course, it helped to kind of be in the society in ancient India where there were seekers, there were philosophers, there were religious teachers who did this kind of thing. But there's something very audacious about that, finding the solution to death. And this is what makes the Buddha so special. He had these incredibly powerful spiritual qualities that made him have the confidence to find something that no one else in the world has the confidence to seek. That is what makes the Buddha so supreme. And this is why this is called the noble search, because we are trying to find something that actually is very elusive, very difficult to find, and it takes extreme spiritual qualities to even dare to enter that particular path. All right, so let us do a little bit more meditation practice. And just to have a chill a little bit, do a little bit more questions, and then we have a tea break afterwards. Okay. Everyone. So, let's do a few questions before we have a tea break. So, yes, please, Bobby, over here. Yeah.
After the extinguishment, how does one feel the bliss, and where does the consciousness go to?
So how do you feel the bliss? Some of the teachings of the Buddha are very profound, right? And one of the problems with this kind of question is that it's very hard to understand some of these things. And so sometimes if the Buddha tells you something, you may think, wow, I'm not sure if I'm interested in that, because it sounds kind of scary. So I think it's important to understand the idea of Nibbana in the right kind of way. So Nibbana, and this is what really matters as far as I'm concerned, Buddha says Nibbana is the highest happiness. It's the ending of all suffering, right? It is the highest meaning of life. And it's the extinguishment of all defilements. And to me, that is what really is important. Because if I understand, that I can understand, I can relate to the idea of the highest happiness. I can relate even a little bit to the idea of ending of defilements of the mind. But some of these ideas may be too difficult to relate to. So extinguishment, what does it mean? Well, think about it and allow the idea to kind of grow on you to understand what it means. And the reason why it is so hard to understand is because we are all deluded. Yeah? And the kind of the root delusion is the sense of self. And the sense of self, if I say that you will be extinguished, the sense of self says, thank you very much, but I'm not interested in that. But it's not you saying that, it's the sense of self saying that, right? The sense of self gets in the way. So to really understand what extinguishment is, first of all, you have to let go of the sense of self, because that gets in the way of understanding these profound concepts. So sometimes I don't like to answer those questions, because I know that it's impossible for people to understand. And then they might get turned away from Buddhism. So much better to kind of have the idea, okay, the highest happiness, I can deal with that. The end of defilements, I can deal with that. But when the Buddha talks about non-self, if you don't even understand non-self, how can you understand Nibbana? Because these things relate to it. So try to understand non-self first. Once you understand non-self in a deep way, then Nibbana is going to become obvious what it must mean. It's no longer a problem. But to give an idea of what the Buddha means, to give you some idea, there's a famous sutta where there is a monk called Venerable Udayin. He says that, well, if Nibbana, how can Nibbana be happiness when nothing is felt in Nibbana? How can something be happiness when nothing is felt? And the answer is, it is precisely because nothing is felt that it is happiness. Where does the consciousness go to? Well, you wanted to go somewhere? Why are you interested in that question?
The body is supposed to be impermanent, but the consciousness is supposed to go on and on.
What if it doesn't go on?
So extinguished. Does the consciousness extinguish too?
Where it extinguishes to? It's like the fire goes out. Where does the fire extinguish to?
Yeah, I know.
If the fire is extinguished, where does it get extinguished to? Nowhere. It just gets extinguished. So the thing is that what is interesting to me is why people ask that question. People ask, well, what happens with consciousness in Nibbana? And the reason they are interested in that question is because of sense of self. That's the only reason. If there is no sense of self, they wouldn't even be interested in that question. Because it would be obvious, it just goes out, no problem. So the sense of self, that's what I mean by the sense of self getting in the way. The sense of self is what asks those questions, not really the... It doesn't, and that's why I find it problematic and difficult, because I know it is very hard to grasp. Bobby, over here.
This is relating to this sutta. So this sutta only mentioned about the human and animal realms. How about the other realms like ghosts? They are also liable to be reborn. Thank you.
Yes, so but the reason why it is not mentioned is because we're talking about the property of this person, right? He is the owner of these things, so he owns the animals. So that's why it is dukkha for him when the animals die. But if the ghost dies, no problem for this person, right? That's not an issue. But yes, if you want to look at the broader context, then yes, of course, animal realms, hell realms, deva realms, yeah, Brahma realms, and realms beyond that. There's all kinds of realms. Sometimes you have to understand all of those realms to understand happiness and suffering properly. When you understand everything, only then can you fully understand happiness and suffering. And then you can make a decision whether giving up everything is okay or not. Yeah. But yes, Petaloka, please.
So we talk about the various contemplations on sickness, old age, yeah. Death. Well, in my own experience, taking it positively or in a proper way, it can be quite nice to contemplate and to have that sort of motivation to do. But I think the other aspect is, as I interact with people and myself as well included, it can also be taken in a very cynical way.
Yes.
And says that, you know, I don't care about any of this anymore, so
right.
What the heck, you know,
yeah.
Forget about life and so on. It can turn the other aspect. So your advice on this, the supplementary question would be, would writing my eulogy be a very helpful tool to help me with these kind of contemplations?
Okay. Yes, it can be taken in a cynical way. I know people who kind of take the Buddhist teaching the wrong way. And when you take it the wrong way, it's like grabbing the snake by the tail. The snake turns around and bites you. And this is a famous simile in the suttas found in Majjhima Nikaya 22, the Alagadupama Sutta, the simile of the snake. And so be careful not to take it the wrong way. When you see that there is suffering in the world, the right response is not to be cynical. The right response is to have compassion, yeah, because you see the suffering in the world. And that compassion, remember, we can do things, yeah? And this is the reason why we are here together now, because we want to do something about that suffering in the world. It is possible to overcome it. And part of the path of overcoming the suffering is precisely to have compassion. We are just talking now about right view, and from this understanding of all the suffering in the world, one of the, after right view comes sammasankappa. It is the result of right view. And one of those sammasankappa is the abhihinsa sankappa. Abhihinsa means non-harming, yeah, or in other words, compassion. Yeah, so compassion is actually one of the right kind of intentions on the Buddhist path. And so if we don't have compassion, if we don't do things in the right way, actually we're not even allowing the second factor to flourish properly and to develop properly. So right view should give rise to compassion. That is the right way. And we can do a lot of good in the world if we are compassionate to others. Yeah, we can really be very supportive. And it's a very important part in your own practice. You're letting yourself down if you're not compassionate. If you're cynical, you're blocking your own path to awakening by being cynical. So please develop compassion, develop care, develop metta, develop understanding, develop some renunciation by keeping precepts, etc. And as you do that, then you are on the right track. Never be cynical. There are so many teachings in the Buddhism that can be taken the wrong way. Another teaching that is often taken the wrong way is the teaching of karma. Yeah, where people say, oh yeah, they are kind of, they are, you know, had an accident because of bad karma. Yeah, it's their own fault. I'm not going to help them. It's their own fault. Yeah, they have been bad. They are bad people. Never think like that. It's incredibly cynical and completely the wrong way of thinking about these teachings. Or you see someone who is born in a very poverty or born in a crippled body and you think, yeah, it's their own fault. Yeah, it's crazy, because we all have this bad karma in us. In your next life, you might be that cripple because some karma you made a long time ago. Yeah, it is all there waiting to come out. And unless we make an end of samsaric existence, we're going to make that kind of karma again. And we're going to be reborn in that state. And anyway, that person who did that bad karma, maybe it wasn't even bad karma. Maybe sometimes when you get reborn as a human, this is what happens to you. Because rebirth as human, there's all these possibilities. We don't know exactly how we're going to be reborn as a human. Not everything is a result of karma. Sometimes it is just the result of being born as a human. And even if they did bad karma, why did they do the bad karma anyway? Because they are deluded. Because they don't understand reality. It's not because they are inherently evil or bad. It's simply because they are in darkness in the world. So again, they're worthy of even more compassion because of that. So never look down upon them. Never be hard on people because they are in bad circumstances. Never think it is their fault. All of this is really the wrong understanding of the Buddhist teachings. Always have compassion. You will also make the same mistakes in the future. You are not superior just because you are more happy in this life. It just happens that in the last life, maybe it was the other way around. Now it's this way around. Who is superior? Who is inferior? Can't really say. There is no inferior and superior. It's just changing conditions, that is all. So we need to be very careful with these teachings. So should you write your own eulogy right now? Yeah, maybe that's an interesting exercise to do that. And then you can, you can say, and then you can actually remember all the good things in your own life, right? Because that's actually what happens when you write a eulogy, because you're always praising each other. And that's kind of nice, yeah? Maybe you become more realistic about yourself. We tend to be too self-critical very often. But everyone here has so many good qualities. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. There's no point in coming here unless you have good qualities. So sometimes write them down, write your own eulogy, and you can tell the people around you when my funeral is, no one is to say a word, you just read this, and this is what I want to hear at the funeral ceremony. Right? And then when you are dead, you are a ghost, you hear all this, you get really happy because you hear all these nice things. So you have kind of double benefit. So that might actually be a very interesting exercise. Anyway, let us take half an hour's break. Let's have some tea and coffee or whatever, and we'll see you all back again at 4:45. Excellent.